Health Department will have immunization clinics 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades. The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas. Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then tomorrow partly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Thank you for listening to Enable this week. We are going to look between the lines of some news stories and find out about their connection to the eyes. You'll be hearing about the opioid crisis, laser pointers at the Capitol riot, and several short COVID pandemic stories about the vaccine, hand sanitizer, face masks, and glasses. All of these stories from the news and their connection to the eyes. I am sure you've heard people talk about the opioid crisis. This headline reads, "Severe eye infections increasing as opioid crisis continues." The information came from the iSmart Journal from the American Academy of Ophthalmology. The article was written by Rena Mukamal and was reviewed by Dr. Natasha Hertz. It was published on February 4th of this year. The article starts, "Vision-threatening eye infections are on the rise in people with drug addictions, according to a new study in the JAMA Ophthalmology Journal. Hospitalizations for a rare eye infection called endogenous endophthalmitis rose 400% between 2003 and 2016 among people with a history of intravenous drug use. The infection can develop when bacteria or fungi enter the bloodstream through the use of dirty needles and then spread to the eyes. Endogenous endophthalmitis is extremely rare, but it can have devastating consequences." Maybe I better take the time right now and spell that infection for you. The word endogenous, E-N-D-O-G-E-N-O-U-S, endogenous. And then we have the big word, endophthalmitis, E-N-D-O-P-H-T-H-A-L-M-I-T-I-S, endogenous endophthalmitis. The new infection caused from drug abuse. The next part of the article says how opioid addiction can lead to dangerous eye infections. The study found a sharp rise in severe eye infections after 2010. And that was the year that regulators clamped down on opioid prescribing. Researchers suspect people with prescription opioid addictions began turning to cheaper, more readily available street drugs. Injected drugs like heroin and fentanyl have become dangerously popular in recent years. Drug overdoses reached alarming levels during the COVID-19 pandemic. Endogenous endophthalmitis is a rare but persistent threat as the opioid epidemic continues. The next section, recognizing and treating endogenous endophthalmitis. People with severe eye infections develop eye pain, redness, and inflammation, as well as worsening vision. A swollen, pus-filled abscess forms in the eye as the infection progresses. Left untreated, the infection can spread to the retina and cause irreparable damage to vision. Doctors treat these infections by injecting the eye with antibiotics or antifungal drugs. Steroids may reduce swelling and inflammation. Surgeons may need to remove parts of the eye damaged by the infection. People with severe infections may need to have their entire eye removed to prevent the infection from spreading to the brain. Even after treatment, some patients remain blinded by scarring that happens when the infection destroys the retina. So the question is asked, when should you seek medical attention for an eye infection? Inflammation and redness in the eyes aren't always signs of infection, but if you have these symptoms, it's important to see an ophthalmologist as soon as possible. People who use IV drugs should be upfront with their doctors so that they can receive the best care possible. And following the riot at the U.S. Capitol building in January, it was reported that at least one of the law enforcement officers suffered eye damage because of a laser pointed at the eyes. This information came from the website www.aao.org. And it's a little bit of background information about laser pointers, which a lot of people use and know about. The headline reads, "Is your laser pointer dangerous enough to cause eye injury?" This was written by Ari Soglin, edited by Dan Dudgel, and it was published on June 22nd in 2018. The greater a laser pointer's output power, the more likely it will cause serious eye injuries, burn skin, and temporarily or permanently impair the vision of pilots, drivers, or even bystanders. That much is clear. But judging the safety of that laser pointer in your desk drawer or in your kid's hand isn't simple. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is responsible for regulating laser devices. Regulations require most laser products to be labeled with a warning about radiation and other hazards, and to disclose the power output of the laser. But this information is sometimes missing, and even if provided, may still not be enough. We have a quote now. "The consumer is in a difficult position," says Daniel Hewitt, health promotion officer at the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health, the agency tasked with enforcing the rule for products that emit radiation. "As power increases above 5 milliwatts, the time margin for safe exposure decreases, and permanent eye and skin damage can occur quickly. However, the output power of laser pointers is not immediately apparent to the user. Laser pointers often lack the required labeling or are mislabeled, and definitive testing of individual pointers is beyond the reach of the average consumer. The FDA does offer advice to help consumers identify which laser products might be dangerous and how to use devices safely. The agency continues to make laser safety awareness a priority as products and toys containing lasers become more common. Researchers have concluded that the wide availability of these devices, which are often marketed as toys, could lead to an epidemic of eye injuries, according to a study released in 2013 by Ophthalmology, the Journal of the American Academy of Ophthalmology. The potential dangers of laser pointers were back in the news in June of 2018 after a boy in Greece permanently damaged his vision by shining the light into his own eye. If a laser with less than 5 milliwatts of output power is directed at someone's eye, that person can blink or turn away without suffering an eye injury. This is with an output of less than 5 milliwatts. However, the natural protective mechanisms of the eye, such as the blink reflex, are ineffective against lasers with an output power greater than 5 milliwatts, and severe retinal damage may occur even after momentary exposure. So here's what the FDA advises. First of all, never aim or shine a laser pointer at anyone. Another good advice, don't buy laser pointers for your children. The third suggestion from the FDA, before purchasing a laser pointer, make sure it has the following information on the label. The label should contain the following four things. First of all, a statement that it complies with Chapter 21 of the Code of Federal Regulations. The label should also include the manufacturer or distributor's name and the date of manufacture. The label should also have a warning to avoid exposure to laser radiation. And the label should have the class designation. This will include class 1 to number, these are Roman numerals, class 1 to 3A. Class 3B and 4 products should be used only by individuals with proper training and in applications where there is a legitimate need for these high-powered products. So again, the class designation that you're looking for ordinary use is Class 1 to Class 3A, and these are Roman numerals. The article continues, "The problem," said Hewitt, "is that the products sometimes lack labels or have inadequate labels." He said about 60% of the sampled laser pointer products that the FDA tests are overpowered compared with what the label says. These pointers may be powered in the tens or hundreds of milliwatts. He also said some labels are too vague to be of any value. Here's a quote, "We've seen one labeled less than 1,000 milliwatts," he said. A consumer may not know what that means. Next in the article, the question is asked, "Is your laser pointer overpowered?" Ideally, consumers could buy a laser pointer with certainty that it's powered under 5 milliwatts. Amazon is trying to make it tougher to sell mislabeled lasers by requiring that all the pointers on its site be backed up by a compliance test report. Hewitt says, as far as he knows, Amazon is the only firm that has taken that step. The FDA says that if you have a laser pointer that isn't labeled, or if you don't trust the labeling, consider the following. There are 8 points for you to consider. If the pointer is small and runs on button batteries, its output probably is less than 5 milliwatts. The second point, if it's pen-sized and runs on AA or AAA batteries, it's likely to be more powerful and may exceed 5 milliwatts. The third point, if it's flashlight-sized and runs on a cluster of AA or AAA batteries, or runs on lithium batteries, it likely exceeds 5 milliwatts. The fourth point that they're making, pointers sold with battery chargers probably drain their batteries quickly and are likely to be overpowered. The next point to consider, some pointers are sold with a removable cap that spreads the beam into a pattern. If used without the cap, the beam becomes a single beam that could exceed 5 milliwatts. Next, look for key words that sellers might use to indicate a pointer is highly powered without saying that it's over 5 milliwatts. Some of the key words they might use is the following, include the following list: powerful, bright, ultra, super, military or military grade, super bright, high power, ultra bright, strong, balloon pop, burning, adjustable focus, lithium battery, lithium powered. These are all trigger words that indicate a pointer is likely overpowered. Another thing for you to look for videos or photos that show the laser burning, melting, balloon popping, or photos that show a bright, well-defined beam of light. These are all bad things. The last one, look for a purchaser comments on websites that tout the brightness or the power of the product. The next section is called Why Blue and Violet Lasers Can Be Even More Dangerous. The FDA also explains why blue and violet light lasers can be especially dangerous. The human eye actually is less sensitive to blue and violet. So while a victim would react quickly to a red or green laser, that person may not blink or turn away as fast from an equally powerful blue or violet light, creating a greater likelihood of injury. After witnessing a rise in the occurrence of eye injuries caused by these lasers, and to better illustrate the dangers of these products, researchers in Saudi Arabia documented the case histories of 14 young males, ages 11 to 30, who sought treatment for these injuries from January 2012 to January 2013. Each of the 14 patients in the study had sustained injuries to one eye. 4 of the patients suffered a full-thickness macular hole, a break in the part of the eye responsible for detailed central vision. Other macular injuries documented in the study included hemorrhages in different retinal layers, a macular pucker, this is when cells proliferate on the surface of the retina, causing visual impairment, another one, a retinal disruption and a cavity in the retina. Only four eyes, that would be 29% of the group, improved spontaneously with increase in vision, whereas 10 of the eyes, or 71%, required intervention, including vitrectomy, which is surgery in which the vitreous gel in the eye is removed, and an operating microscope and small surgical instruments are used to remove the blood and scar tissue that accompany abnormal vessels in the eye. And this, once again, is called vitrectomy. The article ends with a quote, "High-powered handheld laser devices may lead to an epidemic of ocular injuries that requires attention at different levels," wrote the study's authors from the King Khaled Eye Specialist Hospital in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The quote continues, "The difference between these new high-powered laser devices and the low-power pointers cannot be overemphasized, and government actions such as banning the importation of these high-powered handheld laser devices, laws for assault or malicious intent, and a general public awareness campaign may be warranted." And once again, this article about laser pointers was in response to what I read in a news article that one of the law enforcement officers at the Capitol Building riot had eye damage because of a laser pointed at the eyes. The next article, big question circulating these days, did you get your vaccine yet? This information comes from allaboutvision.com. "The COVID vaccine, will it affect your vision?" It's the title of the article written by John Egan. Fear of side effects, including how it may affect vision, ranks as the primary reason that some Americans remain hesitant to be vaccinated against the virus that causes COVID-19. However, no evidence has surfaced yet that any widespread side effects from the vaccine are related to vision. It's worth noting, though, that at least one isolated incident of an eye-related side effect has been reported. A healthcare worker in Alaska experienced eye puffiness after getting a COVID-19 shot. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is investigating this, among other rare allergic reactions to the coronavirus vaccine produced by Pfizer. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, common side effects from coronavirus vaccines include arm pain and swelling where the shot was injected, fever, chills, tiredness, and headache. Here's a quote, "It's totally normal to experience side effects from COVID-19 vaccines," according to Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. The next section, the last section, is called the bottom line. While various other vaccines can cause mostly mild side effects connected to vision, there is no scientific evidence that COVID-19 vaccines trigger eye-related side effects. Experts say the benefits of being vaccinated against COVID-19 outweigh the potential side effects. This page was updated in January of 2021. And information came from allaboutvision.com. This is a website launched in 2020 to provide an unbiased source of trustworthy information on eye health. They're headquartered in Irving, Texas. The next article is titled, "Hand Sanitizer in the Eye, Is It Dangerous?" Written by Vered Hazenchuk, reviewed by Dr. Andrew George Eyewatch, was published on January 29th in 2021. By the American Academy of Ophthalmology. So how far do you have to go to find hand sanitizer right now? You've probably seen a dispenser set up at the grocery store, the gas station, your school, your workplace. Sanitizer at every corner is no surprise. Keeping hands clean is an important and effective way to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Next, they ask the question, can hand sanitizer harm your eyes? Frequent use of hand sanitizer during the pandemic may be causing more eye injuries among children, according to a new study from France. This is from accidentally spraying the liquid into the eye or rubbing the eyes before the sanitizer has fully evaporated. Here's a quote, "Eye irritation from hand sanitizer is a known concern, not just for children, but for adults and healthcare workers too," said ophthalmologist Dr. Sonal Tooley, a clinical spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. Usually, only a small amount of liquid sanitizer will squirt into the eye. This is not as serious as other chemical injuries, and the good news is that complications are rare. If a large amount of hand sanitizer with a high concentration of alcohol gets into the eye, complications could include keratitis, an open sore on the eye, or corneal abrasions, a scratch on the surface of the eye. If you notice persistent irritation after hand sanitizer splashes into your eye, it's important to contact your ophthalmologist right away. Next, they ask the question, what should I do if hand sanitizer gets in my eye? If you get a little bit of hand sanitizer in your eye, you will reflectively blink and create tears. This is your eye's natural way of protecting itself from outside particles. Here's a quote. This will be similar to getting shampoo in the eye and the irritation that comes from that, said Dr. Tooley. If any amount of sanitizer does come into contact with the eye, wash thoroughly with water or sterile saline right away. If symptoms persist, contact your ophthalmologist. And now a few tips how to avoid hand sanitizer eye injuries. There are some simple adjustments you can make to keep your eyes safe. There are four of them. Number one, avoid putting hand sanitizer dispensers at children's eye height. Number two, make sure to rub the liquid sanitizer into your hands well before touching your face. Number three, use foam sanitizer to minimize the force at which sanitizer is dispensed. And the fourth one, this really hit home because this has happened to me. The fourth one, keep the nozzle of the sanitizer bottle clear. Hardened solution can block parts of the nozzle and cause a forceful upward squirt. So there you go, things to worry about that you never realized you had to worry about, right? Okay, next we have an article again from the AAO, Could Glasses Protect Against COVID-19? This was written by Virat Hasenchuk, reviewed by Dr. Thomas Steineman. This was published in January of 2021. Wearing eyeglasses may lower your chances of contracting the coronavirus, according to a new study from Hubei province in China. The findings appeared in a medical journal called JAMA Ophthalmology. The JAMA is Journal of the American Medical Association, and the medical journal is called JAMA Ophthalmology. But does this mean everyone should wear eye protection to prevent COVID-19? Not exactly, says ophthalmologist Dr. Thomas Steineman, clinical spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology and professor of ophthalmology at Metro Health Medical Center. Ophthalmologists say there's not enough information to recommend that people start wearing eye protection in addition to masks. Here's a quote, it's a provocative and fascinating study, but in the scheme of things, this is a small portion of the population. We'd require a much larger study before making any conclusions about whether wearing glasses really does mean people are touching their eyes less often, and therefore decreasing infection rates, Dr. Steineman said. Coronavirus can spread through the eyes when an infected person coughs or sneezes near your eye, or if you touch an infected object before touching your eye. Next section of the article, a possible link between eyeglasses and the coronavirus. The study came from a curious observation made by researchers in China. They noticed that very few of their sick patients wore glasses, which was remarkable since nearsightedness is common in China. They examined hospital records from patients with COVID-19 to learn more. Of 276 patients admitted to the hospital over a 47-day period, only 16 patients, or 5.8%, had myopia or nearsightedness that required them to wear glasses for more than 8 hours a day. Early research shows that more than 30% of people in the region needed glasses for nearsightedness. Dr. Steineman says it could be that glasses serve as a reminder to avoid touching your eyes. It may also be that glasses act as a partial barrier, protecting eyes from the spatter of a cough or a sneeze. There are several factors other than wearing glasses that could explain the study's finding. It could be that people who wear glasses tend to be older and more likely to stay home during the pandemic compared with people who do not wear glasses. Or maybe people who can afford glasses in China are less likely to contract the virus because they can afford to live in less crowded spaces. So they asked the question to end the article, should you wear eye protection to prevent COVID-19? While it's too soon to say everyone should wear eye protection, Dr. Steinemann says that goggles and face shields offer valuable protection for caregivers of infected individuals and for frontline healthcare workers, especially ICU staff and respiratory therapists. For the rest of us, wearing a mask, frequent hand washing, and practicing social distancing continue to be our best bet against the virus. The next article is also from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, and it deals with those pesky, foggy glasses when you're wearing a mask. The headline reads, How to Wear a Face Mask Without Fogging Your Glasses. It was written by Vera Hazenchuk, reviewed by Dr. Andrea Tooley, was published on January 22nd of this year. Even if you've been vaccinated against COVID-19 or have recovered from an infection, it's still important to wear a mask. And with masks comes one of the more innocuous problems of the coronavirus pandemic, fogged up eyewear. This happens when warm breath escapes from the top of your mask and lands on the cooler surface of your lens. As annoying as it may be, don't stop wearing your mask. Masking helps stop the spread of COVID-19. Instead, follow our tips for keeping your eyeglasses, sunglasses, or safety goggles clear. Unfortunately, ophthalmologists are treating more and more injuries in people who weren't wearing safety goggles while masked. They have treated construction workers who suffered ruptured eyeballs after removing foggy safety goggles, and inexperienced homeowners who didn't think they needed to protect their eyes while doing small projects around the house. Here's a quote. If there's an on button or if there's a chemical involved, I always tell my patients to wear eye protection. This is the advice from ophthalmologist Dr. Rebecca Taylor. Whether you are an essential worker on a construction site or just squinting through the fog to see what's on the grocery store shelf, here are some tips to prevent your face mask from fogging up your eyewear. First of all, fit your mask to your face. If your mask doesn't fit your face well, warm air is likely to escape and fog up your lenses. When putting on your mask, make sure to pinch the top of the mask to fit the shape of your nose. If your mask allows it, tighten the sides as well for a good fit. You can use medical or athletic tape to close the gap between the bridge of your nose and the top of your mask. And if you don't have any of that kind of tape, you can even try an adhesive bandage. The next idea? Wipe your lenses before you wear them. Anti-fogging solution or even gently washing your lenses with soap and water before you wear them may help. This will keep water droplets from building up and fogging your lenses. The next tip, number 3 out of 4, adjust your glasses. Pushing your glasses forward on your nose will allow more air to circulate and keep your breath from fogging up your vision. The last one they suggest, rest your glasses over your face mask. Try pulling your mask up over your nose and rest your glasses on top of it. This will block the air from escaping and prevent fogging. If you try this, make sure your mask still fits properly over your face. Your nose and mouth should be completely covered. Well, next, to summarize today's program, you've heard how opioids and laser pointers can damage the eyes, and you've heard details about the COVID vaccine, hand sanitizer eye injuries, glasses and face masks used in the pandemic. Indeed, as you discovered, the eyes are in the news. To end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Beware of false knowledge. It's more dangerous than ignorance. This was said by George Bernard Shaw. Britannica says he was born on July 26, 1856, in Dublin, Ireland. He died in England in 1950. He was an Irish comic dramatist, literary critic, and socialist propagandist. He also was the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1925, George Bernard Shaw. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Clinics offer coronavirus tests. Midland Memorial Hospital, 68 Nurse. MidlandHealth.org. Mobile testing center at West Campus for COVID-19 nasal swab PCR. Must call for appointment. Antibody testing at West Campus or Main Campus Direct Access, 68 Nurse or 221-1111. Cash price for antibody testing, $50.
Throughout the week, we bring you health and accessibility programming. Mondays at 10 a.m., keystrokes. Mondays at 5 p.m., the Assistive Tech Update. Mondays at 5:30 p.m., Blind Abilities. Wednesdays at 10 a.m., the Blindness and Disability News Hour. The AARP Report and the Diabetic News Programs fill out the hours Thursdays at 4 a.m. and 10 a.m., and Sundays at 6 p.m. Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 70 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. Then tomorrow partly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by the Georgia Radio Reading Service, GARS. Hello, I'm Sonal Pathak, bringing you Shape and Women's Health magazines. I'll be reading from the March 2021 issue of Women's Health magazine. The first article is Virtual Reality by Allison Goldman. Where do you go when you feel scared, confused, and lonely after life-altering diagnosis? For many people, the answer is online. Meet 9 self-starters who used social media and digital tools to seek solutions and community they couldn't find elsewhere. We take the World Wide Web for granted, no doubt, as many of us log on during most of our waking hours for work or mindlessly scroll as we're hunkered down on the couch. But for some, online communities are one of the only resources for valuable human connections, and they can truly save lives. When you're dealing with a rare or misunderstood health issue, these groups provide access to support from people going through something similar. A digital space to search, question, cry, and laugh. It might be what helps you not only survive, but thrive. Just ask these answer seekers who turn to, and in many cases created, networks to offer consolation and hope as they navigated the rocky waters on their journeys. Brooke Abbott, 37 years old, motherhood warrior. The first time I saw my son crawl, he was about 6 months old and moving across my hospital bed. It was 2010 and I had been diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, an inflammatory bowel disease, 20 months before he was born. I was in the hospital for a flare-up, and that was the moment I realized how different motherhood was going to be for me. I was hospitalized again in 2012, after which I had my colon removed. Up until that surgery, my ulcerative colitis was not manageable. I was run down and nauseous, losing weight rapidly. But after the colon removal, I felt as if I had been given the opportunity to really live. To start, I turned to writing. I had recently begun a blog, The Crazy Creole Mommy Chronicles, to cover motherhood, politics, and other passions for fun. At my mother's encouragement, I told my ulcerative colitis story there. It was cathartic. I started to make IBD coverage more of a regular thing, trying products that could work for moms with it. I decided to make this my life's work. In 2018, I told another woman in my boat, named Amber, that I wanted to have a platform to offer moms general IBD information, but also lifestyle advice. We started monthly Twitter chats via @IBDMoms. Now we have a website, IBDMoms.org, and multiple social platforms. IBD Moms has helped me, too, as I navigate life with the condition, and I realized how much of a difference the community can make early on. With more information to start, I probably would have been on a better treatment plan sooner and accumulated less guilt over skipping activities with my son due to my health. I wouldn't have felt like an odd person out. Next is Claire Sinman, 44, data collector. I was diagnosed with a rare, non-malignant brain tumor called a choroid cyst 10 years ago in the emergency room. As frightening as the description might sound, I only had 5-minute consults with a neurologist and a neurosurgeon, and was told I'd have further appointments for an MRI to go over everything in more detail. I left with many questions bouncing around in my mind. I went online and within a day or two found a Facebook group for this specific type of tumor. After a serious diagnosis, the ability to chat with people from all over the world at the drop of a hat is tremendous, especially when you have questions that pop into your head in the middle of the night. After undergoing brain surgery to remove the tumor, I struggled with the recovery, including short-term memory loss. I ended up reaching out to see if anyone in the group would do a questionnaire about symptoms and quality of life with and without the surgery. I took the answers to my neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins. Together, we redid the survey, which suggested that patients who had had their cysts removed did have improved quality of life compared with those who hadn't. The findings gave me hope and were published in a peer-reviewed journal. Participants were excited to provide information for patients, caregivers, and also medical experts. That's the power of an online connection. Next is Moina John, 29 years old, inclusivity agent. Between dealing with a new diagnosis out of left field and a pandemic, not to mention attempting to work and parent my 3-year-old, 2020 was the hardest year of my life. On December 31st, 2019, I learned I had multiple sclerosis, MS, after my vision went blurry and my body went numb up to my breasts. I looked into support groups, trying to find a space I felt comfortable. But I kept seeing the same recurring theme. Groups were made of an older white crowd, as if MS was strictly a white disease. It's not. African-American females get MS at a higher rate than previously thought, per a study in neurology. And our MS seems to be more aggressive. I vented to my partner Nick about how I never saw anyone with MS who looked like me, as if I was out here on an island. He said, "Why don't you create something?" I started at Life with Moina on Instagram and later lifewithmoina.com to add representation to the community because it's fantastic but needs to be more inclusive. I love being able to direct message with other Black women who feel comforted when they come across someone acknowledging that. Next is Kelsey Nordstrom, 28 years old, a connection champion. I must have seen 10 doctors over 2 years in my 20s for my awful periods. They all told me the same thing. My stress was causing this pain. I started doing research and I came across the term endometriosis for the first time. The symptoms sounded like mine. I thought, I'm going to talk directly to other people who have this and see what their symptoms are like. So in June 2014, I made an Instagram page to document the good, the bad, and the ugly. By then, I was fairly positive I had endo, but had yet to receive a diagnosis. I started the account to connect with others, trying to find answers, too. In August 2014, I finally found a surgeon who specialized in endometriosis and believed me, and I had laparoscopic surgery, during which they found endometriosis and removed it. I'm not sure I would have had the strength to go through the surgery if I didn't have my community. I used to feel like such a burden to my now husband and suffered from low thoughts. But making the at endo strong page, messaging with others, having somebody say, "I see you, I believe you, I'm with you," saved my life. Next is Fiona Lowenstein, 27 years old, a COVID groundbreaker. It all started on Friday, March 13th, 2020, with a fairly low fever that developed into chest congestion and shortness of breath. I was 26 and didn't have any serious underlying health conditions. I assumed I would be fine. But that Monday night, I ended up at the hospital, receiving supplemental oxygen, because it was so hard to breathe and tested positive for COVID-19. I'm the founder and editor-in-chief of Body Politic, a queer feminist wellness collective. And on March 26, we started an Instagram chat for anyone who thought they had the mysterious, at the time, illness. In those first weeks I was sick, we didn't have the language we have now, like COVID long haulers, or concrete information about symptoms and infectiousness. Via Instagram, we could compare notes. The group grew before our eyes, and soon we needed a different tool. We switched to Slack, a messaging platform, and now we have over 9,000 active members and more than 60 channels, including for different kinds of symptoms, like gastrointestinal or respiratory. We use a Google survey to briefly interview potential members so we can ensure the group remains private and available only to COVID patients and caregivers. We've held Ask Me Anything sessions with experts. When you're going through an illness and not getting better, it's so helpful to have other people who intimately understand that experience. You're physically isolated because you might be contagious, but you're also losing touch with friends because you're not at the virtual happy hour or distanced walk. I've developed friendships with strangers I met in the group that are at this point deeper than the ones I've had from before. I don't want the group to exist forever, but I also see from other patient advocacy movements that once this pandemic is over, people will still be dealing with the long-term physical, mental, and financial impacts of COVID. This could be a long fight, and we're in it together. Next is Tiffany Marie Peterson, 35 years old, a conversation carrier. Within 2 months of being diagnosed with lupus, an autoimmune disease, I decided to be more vocal about what I was going through. I had friends and family who had no idea what was going on, and I had fallen out of communication with them. So I started a Facebook page called Friends Against Lupus. People outside of my circle found it too, and I began to see how many individuals and whole families were affected by the condition. At the time, I also participated in Twitter chats in an effort to learn more about people's experiences with the healthcare system, and I realized there wasn't one specifically for lupus. I started hashtag lupus chat with 3 co-hosts. We hold chats every other Sunday to talk all things lupus related, from pregnancy to nutrition to how lupus can affect your kidneys, with people from all over. I love the sense of bonding that it offers. I never want another person to have the lonely experience I had during those early diagnosis days. Next is Jacqueline Levine Pritzker, 28 years old, stereotype smasher. A few years ago, I was in law school and deeply struggling. I rarely finished tests, and I was always the last one out of them. The school counselor I eventually went to recognized my issues as ADHD. But I told her ADHD doesn't apply to me. I pictured the stereotype of a hyper 12-year-old boy who can't sit still. I didn't think it was something that could impact adult women. So I went down a rabbit hole, learning everything I could about ADHD. By the time I visited a psychiatrist, who diagnosed me with ADHD in December 2017, my mind was changed. I knew I had it. What I found online and via YouTube at the time helped me feel less alone and encouraged me to speak up about my own experience. I craved community and wanted to help show some of the aspects of the condition that I didn't see represented at the time. So in January 2019, I created an Instagram account called @AuthenticallyADHD. I share my journey and post about things that are tough with ADHD. It's not just you who has a hard time closing cabinets. Reminders for people with the condition, like it's okay to struggle with more during a pandemic, and different ways ADHD can present. For example, feeling overwhelmed and hypersensitive. It's become clear that I'm not only building a space for everyone else, but also for me. One of my deepest wounds with ADHD is shame, and the group has been so powerful for me in my healing journey. Next is Aylin Grigosian, DO, MPH, 33 years old, a heart health hero. Women tend to downplay their symptoms. I've seen this not only with my patients as an emergency medicine physician, but also as a patient myself at the end of 2018. I was coughing regularly and extra tired, but I chalked it up to anxiety. Until one day, I felt like I was going to die. That's when I found out I had a heart condition called dilated cardiomyopathy. And in January 2019, I got a heart transplant. I decided, if I'm alive next week, and oh my God, it will be so awesome if I am, I thought I'll use what happened to me to help people understand organ donation and heart disease. I published my first blog post at A Change of Heart, 7 days post-op, and connected with young women who'd had heart transplants. I got them together via WhatsApp chat called Zipper Club, due to the scar on many of our chests. We talk almost every day about body changes with medications, how to bring up a transplant while dating, and more. Most people with heart transplants are older. Now when I see a young person on social media going through this, I invite them to join us. Next is Rina Ruparelia, 40 years old, self-love influencer. It started with little spots on my stomach when I was 14. I was just about to go to high school, and I was mortified. So I tried to cover up my psoriasis as much as I could with long tops, socks, and body makeup. The only pictures I ever saw of someone with psoriasis were at the dermatologist's office. But I realized pretty quickly that this condition goes so much deeper than the skin. I found plenty about treatment online, but nothing on the emotional impact. I started at psoriasis_thoughts on Instagram in 2016 for myself. I didn't show my face, I just posted words and quotes. In one of my first posts, I wondered how anyone would love me looking like this. A few people commented, saying things like, "I get it, don't worry, people will love you." People I had never met, who'd never seen my face. I had this urge to take a picture of myself, so I shared an image of my face in hand. That was a very vulnerable thing for me. When you live for 22 years being embarrassed about a part of yourself, then all of a sudden you stop hiding, it's exhilarating. I began sharing more openly, building confidence and feeling empowered in my skin. 4 years later, I want to be a source of support to people living with and newly diagnosed with psoriasis, to remind them to love themselves. Rocking the mic. What four highly followed doctors who understand the value of social media want people to get out of digital medicine. From at Dr. Jesse Gold on Twitter and Instagram, a reminder that it's okay to not be okay. People feel like getting mental health treatment makes you weak. I put my voice out there to tell people that one of the strongest things you can do is ask for help. From Dr. Danielle Jones at Mama Dr. Jones on all platforms, a peek into the personal. For me, social media is a way to take medicine back to the old days where you knew the town doctor. Now you know me, you know my passion, and you know I truly care about you and your health. I'm just your BFF on the internet who happens to be a gynecologist. From at Dara Kass on Twitter, an access point for all. The ability of physicians to be out there without the barrier of formal networks and media organizations has really helped get information to regular people. And from Fenwa Famakinwa Milhouse, at Dr. Milhouse on Instagram, the amplification of strong voices. As a black woman in a field dominated by men, I seek to change the narrative of what a doctor, surgeon, and urologist looks like. The inside scoop, how to use the stories you find when scrolling to level up your health. Do use social media for emotional context. Scanning a webpage is not the same as reading an account from someone in your demographic. There's value in hearing what it's like to live with a condition, in addition to learning what research says about it elsewhere, says Dr. Shani Ganguly, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a primary care physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Don't use it to paint a full picture. Remember that you're consuming anecdotal evidence, not a complete look at a condition, in general or even for that person. Individual stories are useful as a way of understanding a condition, but it is one experience, says Dr. Ganguly. When you read a post on social, for example, you're likely not seeing an entire medical history. keep things in perspective. Do see your own expert. Patients with a condition are experts in their own experiences and bodies, says Dr. Ganguly. That said, on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, it's hard to judge context and what other background information is going into that. You can absolutely save posts that resonate and do research on trusted sites, but still talk to your doctor about what's going on with you. That was Virtual Reality by Allison Goldman. The next article is It's Personal by Andrea Jordan. Digital devices practically rule our lives, so it's no surprise that skincare's latest trend is also tech-led. The future of your glow has arrived, and the best ingredient is you. When you hear the phrase customized skincare, you may picture products monogrammed with your initials or packaged in your favorite color. And that would be accurate a few years ago. While an Insta-friendly selfie may still be welcome in 2021, the brains in the beauty world are teaming up with scientists to create formulas with your specific skin concerns in mind. By gathering information about locale, are you in the metro or a mountain town? Diet? Are you plant-based or meat lover? Lifestyle? Are you stressed or zen? And even sweat habits? Are you high intensity or yoga? New brands are whipping up tailored concoctions. Yes, we're talking products literally made to meet your needs. The landscape. As a consumer, you can already go on a choose-your-own-adventure of sorts when it comes to what's on store shelves. For example, you can select a foaming cleanser versus a cream one. You can build a routine with a serum that brightens hyperpigmentation or one that reduces the appearance of wrinkles. But with the number of choices being more overwhelming than ever, the decision fatigue is real. That's where this new generation of ultra-personalized goods steps in. Brands like Dermatica and Proven create quizzes composed of various questions about your lifestyle and skin goals to determine which combination of ingredients will benefit you. Meanwhile, Pure Culture Beauty sends an at-home kit to test your skin's pH and oil levels as part of its evaluation. The hoped-for result of sharing these individual details, you'll streamline your routine with products that you know will work, saving you frustration and money. So instead of purchasing two different moisturizers, for instance, you can opt for one bottle that has it all mixed in. The personalized products, on average, range from $25 monthly subscription to $90 to $145 for a full regimen. While it sounds like a lot up front, you could end up saving more down the road because it removes some of the guesswork and trial and error, says dermatologist Hadley King. The process. Here's a quick snapshot of how it all goes down. You'll visit the website, answer a short quiz, then receive results via email and in your profile. You'll then be directed to a page that lists your complete skincare routine and details on how each of the products work. You get to ditch the countless layers of product, too. In most cases, the custom routine consists of a cleanser, a moisturizer, and a treatment product like a serum filled with active ingredients. These programs can also evolve with you. Proven, for example, sends an updated plan as the seasons change. While the provided routine isn't the same across all brands, they typically consist of three or four products to be applied both morning and night, and some only once a day. Customization ensures you're getting the active ingredients you need in formulations for you, so the long list of steps isn't required, says Dr. King. The extent. While it may seem like a customized assortment of products is the perfect answer for skincare woes, keep in mind that it's still so new that some experts aren't sold on whether this trend is more effective than conventional skincare. Without side-by-side study comparisons, it's hard to say personalization is definitively better, says cosmetic chemist Kelly Dobos. As for how custom the products are, Dobos notes there's likely some consistency with the base of the formulation to avoid manufacturing complications. But the beneficial personalization is achieved by varying additives according to the needs of the consumer, she says. Basically, a formula isn't made from scratch for every single person who orders. Yet the range of possible combinations mean a brand can nail your unique mixture. For example, Atola Skincare has multiple base textures and over 30 active ingredients to play with for a never-ending game of mix and match. What's more, to make you a special serum, it considers 21 factors about your skin. the long run. The sweet side effects. Personalization is helping the skin care industry to be transparent and inclusive, says dermatologist Ranella Hirsch, MD, co-founder of Atola. Using this data-driven approach is more sustainable since products are made only on demand, she says. Plus, it can help address diversity gaps by considering skin tone-specific concerns. It's a trend to watch and try, indeed. The next article is Full House. Your desk to cafeteria, or your kitchen, commute is probably pretty short if you're working from home. That's partially why 36% of people reported snacking more this year in an International Food Information Council survey. But, plot twist, that's not necessarily a bad thing. The key is using those midday snacks strategically, so you have more energy to power your day, not less. The afternoon slump is real, but you can get by with a little help from your food. Look for snacks with ingredients that will stimulate your noggin. Choline, a nutrient found in eggs, plays a role in attention and motivation. And magnesium, found in dark chocolate, can help boost your memory and learning. News alert! Expecting your 12 p.m. salad to tide you over until your 7 p.m. dinner is unrealistic. Your blood sugar will fall within 3 to 4 hours, says Marisa Meslum, RD. So eat a healthy lunch and a smaller, nutrient-rich snack around 3:30 or 4 to give your body the jolt it needs. If you're hungry sooner than that, consider it a sign you need a heartier lunch. Food fables. Snacks come in packages. False. We've been taught to see snacks as little bites eaten from tiny plastic packs, but the healthiest thing you can do is get away from that idea. Good news is it's way easier to prioritize unprocessed foods now that you're home, and won't end up with cut fruit spilled all over your tote bag. We've all been there. Snacking promotes unhealthy habits. Wrong. Smart snacks can keep you going strong during those mentally and physically draining workdays by helping control your hunger. Proof: an afternoon Greek yogurt, which is 24 grams of protein, made people feel fuller and delayed subsequent eating in an appetite study. It's all about that protein, baby. Snacks are different from meals. Yes and no. Are snacks smaller? Sure, that's kind of the definition. But if we're talking about the contents of your snack pack, you still want the same macronutrients you look for in a meal: protein, fiber, and fat. Shoot for 2 out of 3. And also, as with meals, there's room for indulging here and there, so don't stress about it. Next level nibbles. Avocado. Cut it in half and sprinkle with some everything bagel seasoning mix. Stuffed dates. Top medjool dates with nut butter, cacao nibs, and shredded coconut. Seasoned chickpeas. Snag some fiber-rich chickpeas and roast them with honey or hot sauce. A tea latte. Mix up a midday matcha with whole milk to stay satisfied and focused. That was Full House. That concludes today's readings from Shape and Women's Health magazines. This has been Sonal Pathak for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening to GARS.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of 2. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
For the lighter side of local news, Recording Library of West Texas brings you the Lifestyle Show. Features from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. We'll feature fun local stories about people in our community, plus columns such as gardening and food. The Lifestyle Show, Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7:30 and Thursdays at 4:30 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.